Diane. Great to be with you. On my mind this week, President Trump is making lots of changes. He's changing our relationship with Germany, changing the U.S. role in the global effort to reduce carbon emissions, and making changes to his staff. But Democrats need to make some changes of their own. I spoke with former senior advisor to President Obama, David Axelrod, about what the Democratic Party needs to do.
It would be a mistake for the Democratic Party to repeat the error that was made before the last election and assume that disapprobation for Donald Trump is enough of a message to win an election.
Then a conversation with one of my favorite actors.
No, I'll tell you what I find upsetting is being in here. I want you to get me out of here. I don't care how you do it.
Alan Alda on how and why we all need to become better communicators. First, David Axelrod. He's a former senior advisor to President Obama and now director of the Institute of Politics at the University of Chicago and host of the podcast, The X-Files. He joined me by phone from Chicago. Hey, David. It's great to talk with you again.
Nice to be with you, Diane.
Give me an idea of what you think Democratic voters are thinking today. Where are they?
Well, I think Democratic voters are activated in a way that they frankly weren't before the last election. It was striking to me, being on the street on the day after the inauguration, how spirited and committed people seemed and how much of a sense of community there was among Democrats on the streets of Washington around, and I learned later around the country that day, and that was missing before the last election. So in that sense, I think the Democratic Party is in stronger shape today than it was last November. But look, you asked me about where the where Democrats are. That is different than where the Democratic Party is. The Democratic Party has a lot of work to do. And it would be a mistake for the Democratic Party to repeat the error that was made before the last election and assume that disapprobation for Donald Trump is enough of a message to win an election. It is not. And Democrats need to be able to argue what they're for and what their vision for the country is. And look, there are two things going on at once here. There are the issues surrounding Trump, but there are also the policy debates that are going on in Congress and around the administration that are really profound, an abandonment of fundamental concepts of equity in our economy that are really, really serious and go not just to the heart of the Democratic coalition, but also touches Trump's own coalition. Democrats need to make the case that they have a vision for how to deal with these macro forces that have buffeted working Americans across the country. And that was what was missing from the last election. Mm-hmm. Hillary Clinton had 100 ideas about the economy, but they were all trees and no forest. And the value of work, and whether we're going to value work in this country, hard work in this country, and whether everybody's going to have an opportunity who works hard to get ahead, that was not central to the Democratic message.
Yeah.
And that has to be moving forward.
Well, but here's what you are quoted as saying in Maureen Dowd's most recent column. You say, we're beyond grief and into disbelief. You say, I feel like a six-year-old has gotten controls of the 747. We're all strapped in our seats, hoping he'll either land the plane or somebody else will co-pilot. And meanwhile, we're just getting jerked around in turbulence on a constant basis here. It's just debilitating now. How do we move from that feeling of debilitation to one of actual confidence that we can control this out-of-control 747?
Yeah. Well, I mean, there are two, as I said before, there are two questions. One is Donald Trump, and all of the issues surrounding Donald Trump and the way he's managing or not managing the government and all the turmoil that surrounds him. That is one question. And, you know, there I think Democrats and Republicans of good conscience have to be a check on the excesses of the president. Diane, that's not fully an answer. In a democracy, the answer is changes of leadership, changes in Congress, ultimately changes in the White House. And so Democrats need to do in the short term what they can to offset some of the impacts of this turmoil.
Like Trump, what and how?
Well, that's congressional oversight is one important way. I think, for example, of the role that Congressman Schiff, Senator Warner are playing.
Yeah.
I think that's important.
Yeah.
I think the role that other Democrats are playing to shine a light on some of these policy areas, Senator Franken has done quite a bit in that regard. Very, very important. So the reality is we do live in a democratic system and Republicans are in control of Congress, but within those parameters, there's still room for Democrats to make an impact. The Affordable Care Act, as we sit here today, is still in place.
Yeah.
And that's not just because of Democrats, but because of Republicans, certainly on the Senate side, who have profound questions about what the House did. I mean, those checks and balances are still in place. They ought to be pursued aggressively, but that's not a substitute for thinking through where the Democratic Party is going and what the Democratic Party and its candidates have to offer.
And that's what I want to ask you about. Do you think there's a lot of pressure for Democrats out there to move farther and farther to the left?
Well, there is some of that. But, you know, it's interesting because some of the issues that we face are shredding these traditional left-right divides. You know, you see people on the left and people on the right who are, for example, anti-trade now because of the impacts on many communities. I mean, I am not one who believes you can put that genie back in the bottle. I think you can manage it better. But it is undeniable that whatever opportunities greater markets have created, whatever it's done to improve the standing of people around the world, which is important to American security, there have been losers. And you know, I live in the industrial Midwest. There are communities that were devastated by trade. So if you see people on the left and right, Donald Trump running as an anti-trade candidate, just as Bernie Sanders ran as an anti-trade candidate, what's happening is you've got these huge disruptions in our economy that are jolting people. You know, that has shaken up some of the old political definitions. But I think the party that will prevail, the candidates who will prevail, are the people who seem to have thoughtful, authentic answers to what's going on in the lives of people around the country.
Contradicting you there just a bit, what did we learn about the election or from the election in Montana last week? And what does that perhaps tell us about what could happen in Georgia?
First of all, we learned that Democrats are going to have to do better than nominating genial troubadours to run for Congress.
And put more money into a campaign.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, you know, I think candidate recruitment, making sure the candidates are properly resourced, the outside spending on behalf of Gianforte were prodigious, $5 or $6 million from outside groups hitting the Democratic candidate Quist with negative ads. There was no real response from outside groups on the Democratic side. There wasn't, as you point out, huge party investment in that race. And I think there was a judgment that because it is a largely rural state, now Democrats have won there. There's a Democratic senator there. There's a Democratic governor there. But because it's a largely rural state, this would be a difficult race to win. Donald Trump, after all, carried the state of Montana by which encompasses the congressional district by over 20 points. Georgia 6 is a real test, though. That's different. that state, that district is a suburban district, and though they've had Republican representatives for 34 years, Trump only carried the district by a point and a half. And as we know, Ossoff, the Democratic candidate, came very close to winning in that long ballot first race. Karen Handel, the Republican candidate, is not a very strong candidate. And so that is a race that Democrats should have a good chance to win. And I think that there'll be a lot of hand-wringing and soul-searching if Democrats can't win that race later this month.
But, you know, the question becomes, is the money going to make all the difference? Ossoff is a good candidate. He has been, it sounds to me as though he has been given support by the Democratic Party. Are they putting enough money in there?
I don't think if he loses, Diane, it's going to be because of money. There'll be $40 million spent on this congressional race. It'll be the most expensive congressional race in history, and I think the money will be on both sides. One of the concerns moving forward to 2018, even if he wins, is going to be he has enjoyed, as did Quist in Montana, a huge influx of dollars from out of the district, national dollars that have come in small donations online. That is easier when you are one of two races that are going on at a given moment. When you have dozens and dozens and dozens of races, that money is going to be divided up among many other candidates. And so there's got to be an organized effort on the part of the Democratic Party to make sure that the candidates have the resources they need and to understand which candidates have the best opportunity to win. And then, as I mentioned earlier, I think there also has to be an effort to really identify candidates who have the best chance to win. You asked me if the party is moving to the left. There is a lot of energy on the left, but it isn't always the case that the candidate who is the farthest left candidate has the best chance to win in these swing districts. And so encouraging very strong candidates who can actually win a district is going to be an important function for the party leadership.
David, let me ask you about something Ted Van Dyke has been writing about, a Democrat who's been active for many, many years. He says that if Democrats stand on the sidelines and don't try to compromise on issues like tax reform, Social Security, that is, find compromises with Republicans, nothing is going to move forward. And then who is going to get the blame if nothing moves forward?
Yeah. Well, I think this debate is one that's been ongoing within the circles of Democratic leadership. There is a strong assumption, and there's nothing that Mitch McConnell has done, or Paul Ryan for that matter, to disabuse people of this notion that honest, good faith compromise is not necessarily going to be available, and that the best strategy is to do what the Republicans did during the Obama years and essentially pursue a strategy of non-cooperation.
Wow.
and hold the Republican Party accountable at the polls in 2018. You know, I was there, Diane, in the first 2 years of the Obama administration. There's no doubt. I mean, Mitch McConnell was very vocal and honest about it. He was honest about it. He said, you know, we didn't want to give him our votes because to do that would be to signify that he had figured this out and we weren't going to give him that. And, you know, it turned out to be a very shrewd, if cynical, political strategy. But, you know, these things, one thing begets another. And even though Democrats, I think, are more inclined to want to make government work, there are a lot of bruises and scars left over from those Obama years.
So if Democrats do not move toward compromise and Republicans with a great amount of money manage to blame Democrats for doing nothing. What happens in 2018?
Well, I don't know that that would be a successful strategy. It wasn't a, now we actually got a bunch of stuff done in the first 2 years, and so Republicans could run against, you know, whether it was the health care law or environmental, climate change votes or so on. We actually got things done. But I think the Republican Party, especially with Trump at the helm and them in the leadership of both houses of Congress and the White House, I think they're going to have a very hard time making the case that Democrats are responsible, just as I think, the president does himself a disservice when he tries to look backward instead of forward and make invidious comparisons and comments about President Obama. I think the Republican Party, if they go into the election of 2018 without any accomplishments, will look like what they are, an unaccomplished party with an unaccomplished president, and they're going to pay a price for it. I don't say that, with any glee, but Diane, I honestly don't see, there is not even an effort on the part of leaders to involve Democrats in a discussion on, for example, health care. So it's very hard to see where this compromise you speak of would come from.
Tell me what your gut reaction was when President Trump pushed himself to the forefront of those foreign dignitaries.
If you wanted a sort of cartoonish depiction of what many in Europe and Asia are thinking, particularly in Europe, the irony someone mentioned to me was that the Montenegrins are one of the few countries represented there who actually are paying their 2% that the president was talking about. But my greater concern was not about the horrific body language, but about the divisive language he used when he spoke. My concern was the message that he sent to NATO about their standing with us and our standing with them, very, very destructive. My concern was also about the absence of any recognition that human rights matter when he was in the Middle East. These are fundamental shifts for our country, and they may reflect, they certainly reflect the philosophy that we've come to hear from this president that, it's America first. We are going to pull up the drawbridge in many ways. And, we are going to embrace autocrats where we think that it serves us. And we're going to turn our back on human rights. These are fundamental departures from American values and American policy for the last 70 years of both administrations. And I found that even more disturbing than the very disturbing body language.
There's been a lot of chatter about the word impeachment. Do you think that there is any chance that's going to happen? And number two, would it be good for the country or terrible for the country?
Well, I think it's terrible for the country to get ahead of ourselves, for sure. The danger of any process like that or any discussion like that is that it suggests to supporters of the president's, and he has a committed core of supporters, there's a suggestion of a kind of bloodless coup that his opponents are engaged in. That's why it's so important, it seems to me, to allow the investigative process to work. I don't know whether there's anything that would be an impeachable offense. People were talking about impeachment before even these latest developments with Comey and the obstruction of justice suggestion and so on. And my whole belief is that we ought not to use that word until that word applies. And unless that word applies, and that's going to be as a result of the work that Bob Mueller is doing. That's going to be as a result of the work of the congressional committees. If in their review of the Russia situation, they stumble across things that rise to that level. But I think it is counterproductive and destructive to use language about impeachment or to suggest impeachment before its time has come. Now, I myself, I responded when the Comey firing happened that this was the first time when it even occurred to me that this is a realistic possibility. And I somewhat regret even saying that much. You know, I thought it was stunning. The firing was stunning. The conversation with the Russians was stunning. All that, but it may not be what it seems like, and that's what the investigators have to find out. So, you know, I would urge everyone to sort of chill out and let the process work. And you know, the habit in Washington is that every day is election day. Every event is the decisive event until the next day when some other decisive event happens. And I think it's best to let this process work.
All right. And I have one last question for you. I know you're not a fashion connoisseur or writer.
That would be an understatement.
But what was your reaction to Melania Trump's wearing a $51,000 jacket in Europe? What do you think the impression was, not only overseas, but to the people back home?
It is an amazing amount of money for an article of clothing, and there's no question about it. But it's not, I mean, if people think that's the most ostentatious thing about the Trumps, they haven't been paying attention. You know, my basic feeling is I have some sympathy for Melania Trump because it seems to me she really isn't that eager to be out there. And she, you know, she's thrust in these positions. There are plenty of people who may want to pile on this one. I'm just not going to.
Well, David Axelrod, what a joy to talk with you.
Thanks,
I hope we'll talk again. Thanks
Please.
A lot.
Thank you.
Now a quick break. And we're back.
War isn't hell. War is war, and hell is hell. And of the two, war is a lot worse.
Alan Alda. He's a 7-time Emmy Award-winning actor, a best-selling writer and director, and, of course, a star in the beloved TV series MASH. Alan Alda's new book is titled, If I Understood You, Would I Have This Look on My Face? My Adventures in the Art and Science of Relating and Communicating. He joined me from the NPR studios in New York City. Alan Alda, what a great pleasure to speak with you again.
It's great for me too, Diane. I love to hear you and I love to speak with you.
Oh, you're
so
sweet.
That covers everything.
Shall we stop right now?
We're a little late, so good night, folks.
Okay. And, you know, we all know you're an award-winning actor and best-selling author, somebody who has been communicating with audiences for years and years, but you say we can all benefit from trying to improve our communication skills. What got you started on this line?
I became aware of what started it when I was doing the science program, Scientific American Frontiers. I did that for 11 or 12 years. And I realized that I had a connection with the scientists I was interviewing that was different. It was a different way of doing a science interview. I didn't have a list of questions to ask them. I just wanted to know what they did and why they did it and how they did it and what it meant to them and that kind of thing. And as a result, there was a better connection between us and the real personality of the scientists started to emerge. And I realized that there was something very valuable happening there. The science could get to the public in a more human way. But what I didn't really realize at the time was that we were able to do that because of the training I had had decades earlier as an actor, mainly as an improviser. And improvisation enabled both of us, when I would be in an interview, to find each other as people and not just exchange information. And I began to realize that that's probably the basis of good communication of any kind is this personal, intimate connection.
Exactly. And that certainly is not for just professionals, but for all of us.
That's right. That's what that's what prompted me to write this book, because I realized that I had spent 8 years helping teach over 8,000 scientists and doctors, and they were beginning to tell us, it's not just for us. This one scientist said to us, this has saved my marriage.
Huh.
So I thought, I got to explore this, how this affects all of us, doctors and scientists on one hand, but also people married to each other, people, lovers, husbands and wives,
and
children and parents, employers and employees, people just in selling things, you know, that if it's not personal, if it's not a real connection, it doesn't go so well.
You bet. And there is one other element, and that is listening. Seems to me that the most important part of communication, at least what I have found, is the art of listening.
Yeah, I agree. It's something that I've found over the years, trying to help people communicate with other people, is if somebody has something he or she wants the other person to know or to understand or to see it that way, their way, the person trying to communicate has to do better listening than the other person has to. The person listening should be listening and taking it in as much as possible, but it's the responsibility of the person talking to make sure the other one follows. It's not, you can't just say, well, look, I told you, it's up to you to get it. It doesn't work that way. That sure doesn't work that way between two people living together.
At least I don't
think so.
In your book, it's wonderful, you describe a scene with your dentist that stands out as an example of the risks of miscommunication.
Right. He was about to operate on my gum, and he said, now there will be some tethering. And I didn't know what he meant by that. And I said, what, tethering? He said, tethering. I said, what do you mean? What is it? He said, tethering, tethering. He just kept yelling at me. And he never, and I was too, I don't know what, I was bowled over by the fact that he was a surgeon. He seemed to know what he was doing. And I didn't say, put the knife down and tell me what you're talking about. Because what happened was he cut that little tissue above, that connects the gum to the lip, the frenum.
You're frenum. Talking about the upper lip.
Your upper lip.
And wow.
Your gum. If you put your tongue up there, you feel that.
Oh,
tissue.
Yeah.
And that was part of his procedure. And my smile was altered by that. My lip would hang down in a kind of sneering fashion.
Wow.
So he gave me a smilectomy, and it didn't explain what he was doing. And then he compounded it later, because when I told him, for the benefit of other patients, I told him it would be good to explain what this is all going to be about. He sent me a letter defending himself in legalese. You know, he wasn't concerned, apparently, with how I felt or what had happened to me. He was concerned that he'd not be sued. I never thought of suing him. But that lack of concern for the person at the other end of what you're doing, in his case, the other end of his scalpel, that has not such good consequences.
You bet.
And everything could be made so much easier by real concern and a show of concern.
You know, the other thing that has been for me very important as a radio host is body language and eye contact. Now, here you and I are talking on a phone line, and I cannot see you. Thank goodness I have seen you several times before, so I have your image in my mind. But body language and eye contact are so important.
They really are. And in our case right now, we have to make use consciously of the tone of voice and the way we speak to each other to let the other person know it's okay to talk again. And so often it doesn't, you know, that doesn't work. I find when I'm at a distance like this, I talk over the other person too much. It's hard to judge. Like, now's your turn.
Well, the other thing that I found myself listening for over the years is the intake of breath, knowing that.
Interesting. Tell me about that. That's interesting.
You know, when people are talking and talking and talking, and sometimes you've got to get into the middle of that sentence to pose a relevant question or to make sure the conversation is not just one way. I have waited for that intake of breath.
And yeah, so then it's a way to get in there.
It's a way to get in there. You bet it is. So the another episode you talk about in the book is when Mike Nichols was directing you and Barbara Harris for The Apple Tree. What was Mike Nichols saying to you?
He kept asking both of us to relate more, but I think he was aiming at me more than he was at her, because I knew that acting involved good relating, but I didn't really know what it meant. And I just kept trying to get closer to her face. I thought relating had something to do with that. But in fact, you can relate to somebody if their back is to you or they're at the opposite end of the room. It's really just being aware of what signals they're giving off that help you read their state of mind. And Mike said, he got frustrated at one point. He said, you think relating is the icing on the cake. It's the cake.
It's the cake. I like that idea. How one relates and whether it means getting closer to a person, leaning towards that person, it involves a whole new set of awareness, if you will, to help that other person understand that you understand.
Right, right. And I find this is odd. I know it sounds odd, but I think it, we, for instance, we've just been talking about the difficulty of not being in front of the person so you can read their face, read their body language, even how they occupy a chair. All of that gives you information about what their state of mind is, what their feelings are. But the funny thing is, I think that when you pay attention to what the other person is probably going through, it even helps when they're not only not in front of you and they're not on the phone or the microphone, they're not even there in time and space. You're writing for them, and you don't know who's going to read it or when or how far away they'll be. And you can actually begin to figure out if your mind is on them, and at least as much as it's on what you have to say to them, how are they processing this? That can affect the way you lay out the sentences one after another. Because as soon as you put a sentence down, you've done something to their brain. And if you think about what that is, what state are they in now? What can I now tell them next? Your focus is on what you're doing to them emotionally and in the thought process. And that can help enormously in clarifying what you have to say.
I wonder if you've noticed, as I have, how much people have sped up their language.
Yeah. Yeah. It is weird. One of the things I've had to adjust to is how language has changed in my lifetime. Words that used to mean one thing now mean another.
Yep.
Phrases. Everybody now says, the word as has disappeared in regard to a verb. You know, as I said before, I was brought up, that was the correct way to say it. Now I hear educated people say, like I said.
Like, exactly.
Yeah, so I just have to swallow it. I have to adjust.
But, you know, I wonder whether the pace of language has sped up so much because the pace of life has sped up so much with texting, with internet, with the email. How has all that affected our ability to relate, to communicate with one another?
It's interesting. There still is a desire to make sure that we're understood. And oddly enough, it comes out in smileys and emoji. We want to make sure, as speedily as we are communicating, as you say, we still want to make an effort to help the other person receive the message in the right state of mind. And so we'll say something that could be misunderstood, and we'll notice that it could be misunderstood, and we'll put a smiley after it to make clear that we don't mean it in a hostile way. So this impulse is still with us. I hope that this book and other efforts like this will help us pay more attention to that impulse, because that's where the real communication takes place. If we drift further and further away from one another, we're going to have more misunderstanding. I was just reading two different experts in diplomacy who said you can't really have diplomacy if you don't keep in mind the point of view of the other person, the other person's perspective. If all you have is your own perspective, you're not going to make any diplomatic improvements, and we're in dire need of diplomatic improvements in the world today, probably more than ever. So I think the empathy that enables you to have the other person's point of view is really important.
Indeed.
And it's easy to lose. It's easy to shy away from.
So what lessons, if any, have you learned about communicating with empathy from Donald Trump?
Well, you know, people have, obviously the country seems very divided about Donald Trump, but I think one thing you can say about him, that in spite of the division, something that I think you can say truthfully is that he knows how to read an audience. And his hour-long rallies without notes, where you might disagree entirely with what he says, but he knows how to play an audience. And that's a certain kind of empathy. You know, the thing about empathy that I didn't understand at first, and I shied away from empathy. I thought it was a touchy-feely term. It doesn't mean compassion. At least not the way I use the term. Many people use it in many different ways. But to me, empathy is just a tool. It's a way you know what's going on in somebody's head in terms of their feelings. And you can use that to their benefit if you have compassion. It doesn't automatically move you to compassion. If you wanted to, it can be a tremendous help for exercising your compassion. But if you want to, you can use it against the other person. A bully has a tremendous sense of empathy in terms of knowing what you're feeling and making you feel worse every time they get a chance to. Interrogators know how to use your feelings to make you feel helpless. That's fascinating to me. It means that empathy is just something you can use and keep in your toolbox. It's a tool. So to say somebody has empathy doesn't mean you agree with them.
Tell me what you mean and how you would describe total listening and how you could teach others to be total listeners.
I think it's something that's difficult to describe, and I think you have to go through experiences over and over again to get good at it. While I was writing the book, I actually, something curious happened to me because I was so so concentrated on trying to find out how I could improve my own empathy and therefore my own ability to communicate that I started experimenting with exercises that I could do by myself. And then a scientist actually studied this, and his study suggests that it's actually a good idea to do this. And what I do is, while I'm talking to somebody, if I haven't started to do it automatically, I tell myself, read their face, observe them. Sometimes I'll be talking to somebody for 5 or 10 minutes, and when I goose myself and say, pay attention to them, I suddenly notice what color their eyes are, or what color their hair is, or what color the jacket is they're wearing. And something changes in me when I do that. I have a different feeling toward the person. I'm more personal with them. I am aware that something happens on my face. I seem to be more interested in them. And I see their face change in response. And we get connected better. And this comes from the simple act of observing them, paying attention. And I think that is a tremendous start to having a conversation that goes somewhere where you're actually listening to each other.
There were some other studies you pointed out in a book about people marching together and how when they begin, they're marching to their own drummers, if you will. But then as they learn to march together, that ability to be in sync with each other does something to the brain. Describe what you mean.
It's very interesting. The scientists started with marching. They had one group just walking together around the campus and another group that was marching in step. And as I remember, they gave them a standardized empathy test before the event and after the event, and the scores went up. They were more. If not a standardized empathy test, it was at least a test that showed whether or not they were more able to think of themselves as a team, as a group, and be more cooperative with each other. And that they did. They found that it worked even if they were tapping together, not just marching.
Tapping? You mean tapping on a table like this?
Yeah. Isn't that
in rhythm?
Let's tap together.
Okay, let's. I love that.
Oh, I feel better about you already.
Well, Alan Alda, you are now 81. I am 80. I know what's ahead for me. Tell me what's ahead for you.
Adapting, adjusting, and I really am enjoying adjusting at every step along the way. Things work a little less well in our bodies when we get to this age. And we can complain, which I sometimes do, or we can do this thing that I'm learning how to do, which I really love, which is to say I can't run as fast. I'll run better. I'll start sooner. You know, I still play tennis a couple hours a week.
Good for you. Yeah.
So I love it. But, you know, I'm not as swift as I used to be, but that's fine.
And your career?
I act, but I've made the adjustment there that I really only want to act in things that excite me, that I find really deeply interesting. Last year I did a web series that I knew not a huge number of people would watch, but it was written and directed by Louis C.K., who's an extraordinary writer and a really fine actor. And he had a wonderful cast who was called Horace and Pete. And I played a character I'd never played before. And I had the best time, and I had such a good time that I haven't found anything in the year since then that I've wanted to do. It set the bar higher for me. And that left me more time to work on communicating. So I have a charmed life. I'm very, very lucky, and I know how lucky I am. Anybody who does what gives them pleasure is really lucky.
And that's why I'm still doing what I'm doing, absolutely.
And you're so good at it.
Thank you.
I love listening to you interview people.
Thank you so much, and thank you for being with me today.
Thank you, Diane. I had a great time, as always, with you.
I'm glad. Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Now, from the archive this week, as we head into the summer of 2017, a look back at an eventful summer nearly a century ago. Writer Bill Bryson came by our studios in 2013 to talk about his book, One Summer, America, 1927.
My starting point was I had it in mind that I might try to do a kind of dual biography of Lindbergh and Ruth, these two characters that had fascinated my parents and were, you know, obviously iconic figures. And I'd always been kind of drawn to the fact that they both had these career years at the same time, the summer of 1927. But what I found when I started looking into it, just at the very beginning, I found that a whole lot more happened that summer. I mean, you had the great Mississippi flood, still the biggest natural disaster in American history. You had the filming of The Jazz Singer, the first talking picture, which obviously transformed popular entertainment completely. They started carving Mount Rushmore. Sacco and Vanzetti, these notorious anarchists, who I fear are slightly forgotten now, but were a huge cause celeb at that time. They were executed that summer, and which provoked riots all over the world. So lots and lots of stuff happening all at the same time.
You can listen to that entire show at dianereem.org. And that's our show for the week. Let us know what's on your mind. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Leave us a voicemail at 202-854-8851. Or you can send us an email or a voice memo. Our address is drpodcast@wamu.org. We really value your comments, your thoughts about our podcast. Our theme music was composed by Cliff Harden, comes to us courtesy of the Capitol Soundtrack Project here at WAMU. The show is produced by Sandra Baker and Rebecca Kaufman. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.